Carl André, we're standing in the upper gallery here at the Museum of Modern Art, Oxford, on your piece titled Six Metal Fugue in brackets for Mendeleev, 1995. A large, impressive work, but before we talk about it in detail, could I ask you a more general question? Could we talk about the way in which you've titled this exhibition, which is Carl André, Sculptor, 1996? I mean, in one sense, the exhibition could be described as a retrospective, but the title emphasises the sense of the works existing in the here and the now and not separated from the sculptor or current practice. Perhaps you could elaborate on your titling of this whole exhibition.
This exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in Oxford, which is really a Kunsthalle and not a museum, but is a selection of 16 works from the large dual retrospectives that have just closed in Krefeld and Wolfsburg in Germany. There are over 50 works in that exhibition. The title of those exhibitions taken together was Carl André Sculptor in 1996 because it is, you might say, a presentation of my work, state of the art, as you might say. It's a cross-section of my work over the years presented now, and of course all work is in the present. There's no other time that we can experience them.
So if we could now talk about this piece we're actually standing on, which is in the centre of or at one end of the large gallery upstairs at Oxford, called, as I said earlier, Six Metal Fugue for Mendeleev, which was made in 1995. It comprises 1,296 identically sized square plates made using six different metals, and I think you've said that the theme of the sculpture gradually unfolds and it's reminiscent of the fluctuations and repeats of a musical fugue, and this creates a spectrum of tones which, due to the expanse of the work, reveals itself only gradually, but there's also this issue of the periodic table that determines its structure.
Well, the statement you just read contains fragments of things that I've said, but I call it a fugue. Of course, music is a great inspiration for all art, and was it Ruskin who said all art aspires to the condition of music? The structure of this work, to me, resembles a fugue because there is a statement of the six metals in 6x6, 36 unit squares, and it begins with each metal by itself, 36 aluminum, 36 steel, 36 copper, 36 zinc, 36 tin, and lead, if I've left one out, perhaps. Then they combine in the combinations of pairs, aluminum and steel, aluminum and copper, aluminum, zinc, aluminum, tin, aluminum, lead. And these units, it's like a theme in a fugue which combines themes together to make new structures.
And this piece was made in Germany and transported here?
Yes, it was fabricated in Germany for the exhibition in Wolfsburg. In Krefeld, you had two villas that were designed in the 1920s by Mies van der Rohe for art collectors. And the works in the two villas in Krefeld were, as I said, at home. That is, they were living room size and smaller. In Wolfsburg, where they have a very new museum that can clear its partitions entirely, and it was possible to fit 10 of these 36 by 36 foot pieces in the main hall at Wolfsburg, or in fact one could have installed the two villas from Krefeld in that space. So in Krefeld was at large, there were large pieces in Wolfsburg.
Is it in any sense like other works you've made where it could be rearranged in other configurations, or you know, is this the way in which it has to be seen as one entire square or rectangle?
Well, I make very few works that, shall we say, have a random, intend to have a random arrangement. This is a work of fixed configuration, and almost all my works are of fixed configuration.
What's your feeling about the piece installed here in the upper space here at MoMA?
Well, very good thing about the museum here in Oxford is it does have a space large enough to contain the work. It fits almost as if it were exactly designed for the space, which, of course, it was not. But we could install it here because there is a 36 by 36 free span, which is quite a large space.
As well as this piece in the upper gallery, you have three other pieces.
Yeah, perhaps you could describe these other pieces.
To the right is Ash Convex Pyramid, which is a reconstruction of a work done in 1964, which was in itself a reconstruction of work which was done in 1958 and 59. And those are made of slotted and joined timbers, in this case 4 inches by 4 inches by 36 inches. And they are in stacks of receding and intersecting right angles.
The piece in the center.
The piece in the center is a timber piece from roughly 1980, I would say, and that's called Romatier, and that is made of 12-inch wide, 36-inch long Western red cedar timbers, and it's horizontal on the floor, and there are 5 horizontal spaced by pairs of, they're all horizontal, but 5 lateral timbers spaced by 4 horizontal pairs of horizontal timbers.
And then one other piece on the left called 25 Cedar Solid, 1992?
Yes, that's 25 Western Red Cedar timbers. Each one is 12 inches by 36 inches, and they are on end, making a solid block of 5 by 5, a solid square block of timbers.
Just now, they've recently turned off the lights here in the upper gallery, so the piece, Six Metal Fugue for Mendeleev, suddenly becomes very different. I think it becomes very flat. It emphasizes the gravity almost of the floor.
My work, as been said, does not rely on illusion. There's nothing wrong with illusion in art. I just happen not to be interested in it.
Could you talk about the way in which, though, it interacts with and relates to the space? Is it a question of the piece activating the space, or the other way around, or a combination of the two? Because it does actually alter the feel of this gallery aesthetically.
Well, certainly. A work and the space that contains it are in a dialectical relationship. We tend to forget that all works of art which are experienced must be somewhere. Perhaps it's because we experience art largely through reproduction in books. We don't think of artworks being in a space, but all works of art to be experienced have to be in a space. The lights were just turned on off because there's a great deal of diffuse natural light which is available, and a shadowless diffuse light is exactly what I think is best for my sculpture. It's exactly the kind of light that Cézanne used to like to paint from in nature, without shadow.
And the relationship to the human scale with this work is, I think, quite interesting and challenging and quite a new experience for me. I mean, I know that individual components can be picked up, as with most of your works, but here one has to physically stride across it maybe 10 times to get to each to the ends of the piece in each direction.
Well, my works, not quite consciously, but definitely have always been limited to my quite limited physical capacity. So the units of my work are always units that I myself can manipulate quite easily. I'm not a kind of sculptor who is a voyeur in my own work. I couldn't stand watching my work being done, my pleasures in making my work myself. So all my works are scaled to my limited physical capacities.
And just finally about this piece, the actual choice and location of the metals you used, that was pre-organized, presumably.
Oh, yes, I knew what materials I was going to order, and I knew when they were delivered, and I knew that I wanted to order them in the sequence of their atomic number, from aluminum being the lightest of the metals that we're dealing with to lead, which is the heaviest of the metals we're dealing with. Those are givens. Those are parameters that one works with.
Mm. Should we move into this other room then?
Certainly.
Through.
And as you can see, we've gone from a large, high-ceilinged open room with natural lighting to a low-ceilinged, pillared room with only artificial lighting. On the floor of this room, we have 25 Western Red Cedar timbers, 12 inches by 36 inches each. And there is the same number of timbers in this room, and this whole rather small room is filled with these timbers in random orientation. That is, the timbers are not, they're all horizontal, they are not touching, and they are not parallel. We have to refer back to 25 Cedar Solid because they were made at the same time for the same exhibition in Dusseldorf, Germany. That work you can see is the 25 timbers as a compact unit. Here is 25 timbers dispersed, and it's a work, it's two works, but they are in a relationship with each other as two ways of disposing of the same material.
Can you talk then about the process of installation? I mean, you've just described this as the same way of disposing of the same material, but what is the process of making the installation with these elements?
Well, in 25 Cedar Solid, the timbers are placed horizontally and they are pushed together as tightly as possible in a 5x5, 25-unit square of vertical timbers. Here, you dispose of 25 Western Red Cedar timbers horizontally and as much as possible not related to each other, not compacted, not pressed together.
Shall we move to another gallery?
Yes.
Which is the best way, do you think?
That way, probably. I just want to check out this information room, an education thing for the year.
This refers to, well, this is the education room.
These are photographs taken by Eva Meyer Hermann, who is the genius, actually, who put this exhibition together in Krefeld and Wolfsburg and now in Oxford. And she visited Quincy, Massachusetts, where I was born and brought up, because I've made it very clear that my earliest experiences very much influenced the work I've done now. Quincy, Massachusetts was a city of granite quarries and granite cutting yards and of shipyards, and from my earliest recollections were great blocks of stone and quarries and large areas of steel yards covered with flat steel plates. So the themes of my work really continue. Henry Moore, the great English sculptor, said that the work of art is to recover the vividness of our earliest experiences, and I find that absolutely true.
So we have an image of a granite quarry, and here now an image of
the shipyard where many of my uncles, my father worked, and many of the my male relatives and female relatives, for that matter, worked in the shipyard. I remember in 1941, I went with my family to witness the launching of the battleship Massachusetts from those very shipyards. Here we happen to see the current use of the shipyard, which is to make very large reactor vessels, actually, for a sewage treatment plant in Boston Harbor in Massachusetts. And the irony is there are plenty of steel plates on display at the shipyard, but they're all curved because they're making domed reactor vessels for the sewage plant rather than the flat metal plates, which I saw as a boy, that were used for making the hulls of ships.
So those industrial processes and the materials used within them have in fact remained consistent themes in your work over the last 30 years.
Absolutely. My father's family was a family of bricklayers and carpenters and builders and shipbuilders. And so my earliest experiences are not of art, but of the materials from which the world around us is constructed, and those are the materials that I can continue to use. I never had to renounce the art supply store because I never did anything that required the art supply store. And the art supply store, if you buy a copper plate there, it's going to cost 50 times as much as you could spend if you went to the copper supplier directly. So I never renounced art materials, so-called art materials, in order to work with industrial materials. I've always used industrial materials and never been tempted to use materials inappropriate. All artists should simply use the materials that are appropriate to their ends. It's a false issue to say this is industrial and this is art material.
Right. Shall we move to the other space? Here we are now on this little half balcony looking over this large piece upstairs.
Now we are looking at it only with the diffused natural light. I think it's become a bit of a cloudy day. It was more brightly sunny before. But the work has less glitter with the artificial light shut off, but I think it just becomes clearer in structure with the natural light.
Right, we'll go down.
Thank you.
Well, now we've come down to the Piper Gallery, and there are two works here.
This is a work called Sandlime Instar, and it contains eight islands, if you will, of sandlime brick. Each island of brick consists of 120 bricks in two layers, giving you a floor plan of 60 bricks each. Each brick island has the same number of bricks, but 60 is quite rich in factors. So we can have 3 by 20, 4 by 15, 5 by 12, and 6 by 10. We could also have 2 by 30, but I did not use the configuration 2 by 30. Now, since each brick is an oblong, a rectangle and not a square, each of the chosen factors is a pair. So we have a work which is 3 by 20, but it will be 3 the long way and 20 the narrow way, or 20 the long way and 3 the narrow way, which will give you the same area, the same volume, but a different configuration for each one of these islands of bricks. And together they make up, in 1966, they made up the work called just equivalents. They were not called equivalents 128. That was something that happened later in 1969. But they were simply called equivalents in 1966. It was meant as one work. When the exhibition was over, the gallery where I showed the work was not interested in storing it. I had no place to store it. So all but one set of 120 bricks, I was forced to return them to the brickyard. Only one of these original sandlime bricks from islands exists now, and I believe it's in the collection in Switzerland. In 1969, the remaining seven islands of brick from the original, but they weren't remaining, of course, they had to be reconstructed, and the 1969, the remaining seven, not remaining seven, of course, that's a confusing issue, the reconstruction of seven was done in fire brick, giving a different color and a different size, although the same principle of the equivalent number of bricks in each one. It was never reconstructed then as one whole work, but as seven separate works. And it was one of those seven separate fire brick reconstructions of the individual islands from the original 1966 show that the Tate Gallery bought as equivalent eight. Now, this installation is here, the Sandlime Instar, is in the same configuration, the same material as the 1966 exhibition. It's a complicated story. People have difficulty following it. It's worth explaining.
I suppose by now, when you come to Britain, you get fed up being reminded of that whole furore over what is now, you say, described as equivalent eight.
Well, it was only an accident of publicity that I was singled out. The campaign which was carried on against the Tate, which was quite a concerted one, and I've heard that Douglas Cooper was the chief inspirer of the attack against the Tate. He evidently had a long-standing grudge against the Tate, and it was an attack against the Tate collecting contemporary advanced art by artists who had not yet had auction room reputations. As a result, the Tate then was able to buy a great number of works from artists like Richard Long and Barry Flanagan, who have since become very well known. So the Tate actually, in 1974, when they made those acquisitions, was getting a bargain. And now, I suppose, if the Tate bought an auction for millions of pounds works by Barry Flanagan or someone like that, they would be considered to be doing wonderful work. I find that whole attack and campaign was nothing but a Philistine attack on contemporary art, and it was only an accident that bricks got chosen. It could have been a Richard Long boulder piece or a Barry Flanagan pile of sand.
It was just the moment then that...
It was an accident. I happened to be the one singled out. Was entirely an accident.
There's one terminology that seems to be used and has been used over the last sort of 5 years increasingly, which is that of site-specific to describe sculpture. And I wondered what you thought about that in relation to your own practice and where you make works. Are they site-specific in that sense?
Well, they are site-specific in the sense that I have always gone to a specific site and made the work there. It's not site-specific in the sense that I tried to design a work for a specific site. Rather, the specific site for my work has been one of the limiting values of the work. I always work on location. I've never had a studio. In the beginning, I didn't have a studio because I couldn't afford a studio. Later on, I didn't have a studio because we just became a warehouse for the accumulation of my materials. So I always worked on site. So for the creation of the work, the site is specific. But for the display of the work, it can be displayed at any other site that has, you know, adequate lighting and adequate space to contain it.
And are the drawings made in order to formulate the positioning and the structuring of the works before they're actually ordered?
I don't make drawings for my works at all. I order the material and I go to the site and I do the work. Drawings sometimes are made afterwards by other people in order to aid in reinstallation of the work. But I don't work from drawings. I don't work from models. Perhaps it's a sign of my extreme limitation. I can only think with the material in hand in the space where the work is to be made.
Well, now downstairs in the Goodman Gallery, Carl, you have four pieces from, 1971 to 1990. Two flat pieces on the floor and then another work comprising timber. There's a very strange feeling in this gallery because it doesn't have natural light. It's completely enclosed. So there's a sense of, not claustrophobia exactly, but something of being closed in a space, which is completely opposite to the sense of the upper gallery, where the light somehow mediates the work and draws it out of the floor to some extent, or gives it a resonance. Is light, to what extent is light an important issue for you?
Well, I remember a time when an exhibition was being discussed with Ad Reinhardt, the wonderful American abstract painter of what ultimately were the almost completely black paintings. And Ad Reinhardt wanted to put a white wooden stanchion in front of his painting because it was subject to a lot of public abuse, fingerprints and so forth. And the other nine artists in the show were sculptors, and we were joking with Ad Reinhardt about how he was trying to become a sculptor with his protective stanchion. And Ad Reinhardt used a remark I had heard him using before, which was, sculpture is what you trip over when you back away from a painting to look at it. And I immediately said to Ad Reinhardt, I said, well, when you turn the lights out, Ad, the painting disappears, but you still trip over the sculpture. So light, of course, is, you could almost say everything is made of light, ultimately. We look at light as the form of electromagnetic energy and E equal MC squared and so forth. So in one sense, we're all made of light. But all the materials of the world have different colors and different chromaticisms, and it has many other properties, too. I would, just as we say of a painter is a colorist, I think of myself as a matterist. I try to deal with the varieties of matter the way a good painter deals with the varieties of color.
And the actual horizontality, if one can use that word, of many of your pieces, I've read you talk about referring back to, you know, your earlier experiences on the railroad where things are very flat, and also canoeing where the water's very flat. And that there's been mention of a kind of an opposition to the idea of the endless tower, the Brancusi work that goes up and up and up. I mean, is that a fruitful dialectic for you?
Well, Brancusi, of course, was a great inspiration for me, and especially the endless columns. Of course, no endless column is, in fact, endless. They are in various sizes. That was, the endless column was meant to be displayed vertically, but Brancusi actually hewed them, cut them, carved them with the timbers in the horizontal position, and the work last ladder, which is in the collection of the Tate Gallery of mine, is the last wood chiseled piece of mine, and it also was cut horizontal on the horizontal position because that's the easiest way to do it. I just stopped raising my timbers vertically and started using them horizontally. I continue to do sculptures in the vertical extension. The hinge on three right thresholds is a tall vertical piece. But most of my works are horizontal because that's the most efficient way to use the material. One could take, we see in one part of the gallery, the long rectangle 3 by 39, which is the 3 by 13, which is the 39th copper cardinal. Now, one could stack those 39 plates one on top of the other, but one would get a rather small, compact sculpture. I find the horizontal extension gives a more efficient disposition of the material.
The materials in the two pieces that are in front of us seem to be copper.
Yes, all three are in copper. There are three. There are two cardinals. There's the 39th copper cardinal, which is the long 3x13 rectangle, and there is the 5x5 25th copper cardinal, and there's a third piece, which is a slant piece, which is in meters square copper plates, the base plate of which is angled, is cut in an angle, so the work does not extend into the room at right angles, but rather at, I would say, roughly a 70-degree angle from the right angle. The three copper pieces, although the copper is essentially the same in each one, are in three different conditions. The 25th copper cardinal obviously has been on display for a long time and has had a lot of traffic and becomes the dark, leather-like brown color of copper when it's just naturally aged and weathered inside. And the 39th copper cardinal is a mix of fresher-looking copper plates with more weathered copper plates, which makes me think that the people who have been displaying this work have not been displaying all the plates of the work, but have perhaps reduced it to a smaller size to fit their space, which is entirely a violation of the work. But that's why it has a party-colored look. And the plates of the slant piece are all pretty much in the same state of weathering, which is half between bright and half between darkening.
That process of, I suppose it's chemical discoloration or chemical change to do with atmosphere and the way in which people walk over it, creates a very rich and varied surface on these metal plates, going from very bright, shiny copper through to cardinal 25, I think, which is now very somber. And presumably that is embraced in terms of your intention with these works, that change.
Yes, absolutely. For me, there's never an ideal state for my work. There's not one state like a new automobile. You want to keep it bright and shiny, and you're sad if it gets dented or anything. The things of this world are in constant change, and the idea that we could fix them in any one particular state is an illusion that I'm not interested in maintaining. So my works change constantly, and that's something that people have to accept if they accept my work.
To the final space, which is the back gallery, and just as we do that, there are some more timber pieces here, and the only intervention really that you are making with this timber is to cut it into rectangular configurations.
Well, I hate to disappoint you and your listeners, but I don't even do that. I order my materials from the people who have the machinery to cut it. Here we have timbers, again, in the unit of 12 inches by 36 inches square, Western Red Cedar. There are, eight timbers in each one. Each piece is in a compact cube, but it's in a different configuration. It is not in a compact cube of nine, which would be possible if they were simply all vertical, but they are an array of horizontals and verticals interlocking, such as to make a cube with spaces within the cube which are voids.
And the piece that is centrally placed here in this gallery is a piece of granite?
It is made of granite from Quincy, Massachusetts, which is the city where I was born and grew up. And as I said, it was a city of granite quarries and granite cutting, as well as shipbuilding. And these were blocks that I had cut from Quincy granite, which still lies around the abandoned quarries. It's impossible to get granite cut from the Quincy quarries anymore, but they're essentially exhausted and have been for perhaps 40 years. However, the work was cut in Quincy, and it's in blocks 6 inches by 6 inches by 18 inches, and these have the configuration similar to that of Rome Mater, which we've already spoken of, which is a series of lateral blocks that are spaced by pairs of longitudinal blocks, which leaves, vacant spaces, cells, between each set of essentially three blocks, two longitudinal and one lateral.
And the final piece in this space is, for me anyway, an uncharacteristic work, which is a very thin length of copper that bends according to the curvature of the material along the wall. Is this an untypical work?
It is indeed. It's extremely exceptional for my work because it is in one continuous unit, and my works are always done in particles, except with these very, very few exceptions. And also, it's a work which does not have a self-determined configuration. In other words, this band coil of copper can be unwound in many different configurations. There's not any particular one that is more or less dictated by the shape and the number of the elements. That is quite exceptional. But for my birthday last year in 1995, I returned to this theme, which I haven't done since 1970, I think. And I did a work in Switzerland for my birthday, which was a large roll of copper that was 20 centimeters high and was 100 meters of copper, but I unwound it to a coil of about 2.5 meters across. So this is a theme that is extremely rare in my work, but the one thing that is absolutely consistent in my work is that the material is the strongest and most evident component of the work.
And very finally, you mentioned the word particles, and I remember in early 1970s we spoke about your exhibition of poems at the Listen Gallery, and you talked about language and your use of language in relation to particles of meaning. And I wondered whether that the process of making poems is still part of your overall project.
Oh, yes, I still do poems, and I still employ words as particles of various length. And I'm certainly aware of that the linguistic part of the brain is a different part of the brain from the visual, tactile, and spatial parts of the brain. But it's possible to enjoy language visually also. Of course, it was a great example of Chinese calligraphy, where you have both the linguistic areas and the visual areas of the brain highly stimulated. So I hope that people continue to enjoy poetry. I hope they continue to enjoy art, but I hope they'll stop confusing the two.
Liam Gillick, we're in your show in the Robert Prime Gallery here in London, and you've titled it The What If Scenario. I have only just walked in and seen it, as you know, so I think it would be quite interesting to start off with if you gave me some sort of overview of the general and underlying concerns of the work.
In the last couple of years, I've really been playing with a series of ideas that I think of now as parallel histories that really came about as a result of a kind of process rather than as an initial set of philosophical or precise concerns. But they tended in general to deal with ideas of the past or the recent past, and certainly also to do with certain secondary or parallel characters from the past. And I'm thinking in particular about the cartoon and film that I wrote called McNamara, and also the two books Erasmus is Late and Ibuka. And in a way, what we're dealing with in this gallery is something that is an extension of that thinking. And as a result of writing those two books, I was given a lot of other texts, bits of information. People really reacted to those two books, and I began to read a number of what you could call utopias, books often written at the end of the 19th century, trying to think about the future. So I was reading these books, in particular one by Edward Bellamy titled Looking Backward, which was written in 1887 and is basically set around now. And as I read these books, I was struck by the extent to which a lot of the content has come true, that when you look around you now, you can say, well, these books were fairly accurate. But on reflection, I realized that this shouldn't be too much of a surprise, because thinking about the future tends to change the future. So as a result, I became much more interested in the aspects of these kind of texts and this kind of thinking that hadn't come true. And from this mass of material that was building up in my head, no written material or anything like that, I started to develop a kind of parallel present that was based on people's imagination of what our time could be. And I thought this was interesting in a way, but maybe not enough to really sustain me in the work I was trying to think about. What I decided to consider instead was really a way that you might start thinking about a future, not based on this present that we're living in, but based on this parallel present, and see what happened. Because I'd evolved this working technique that tended to involve the creation of a text or a really central core to something, and then the production of some objects or some stuff, I decided again to work the same way. However, of course, once I started doing that, I tended to be writing a kind of science fiction or something very familiar, very fictional, very rather unsatisfactory. So I abandoned this central core, this textual core that I'd been using as a technique, and decided to make some images, some objects, some propositions, so that maybe at some point in the not-so-distant future, I could actually write this predictive report. So what you're seeing when you walk into the gallery is a number of basic elements that I need to begin thinking about the what-if scenario.
Shall we actually look at some of the actual pieces? And I think one of the things that I found interesting was the idea of a predictive report. And there's a piece in the corner of the upstairs gallery here, which is, I suppose, a structure, a platform that is above head height, whether it's a platform beneath which one would meet other people, whether it's a platform that one would stand on, but it's an aluminium structure with coloured perspex over it at about 6'6". Could you elaborate on this particular piece?
Something that's very crucial to understand about the show is the extent to which all the objects and all the elements presented somehow have a rather, not symbolic function, but a rather a function that is about some fundamental ideas that you would require in order to think about the future based on the present that's not taking place. So this piece is called a discussion platform because I recognize the necessity for there to be an area where people might interact or discuss certain ideas. Now, the thing is, what you end up with is a problem of how to formalize that, how to create an actual formal object that reflects those ideas. And because, as I said before, I'd abandoned this rather rigorous technique of having a textual text base for work in favor of first making the images and the objects, I didn't need to stick too rigorously to a predetermined set of ideas before I could make the object. So to a certain extent, I was considering things like a certain form of rough seduction, a desire to react to specific architectural archetypes. So what I've really tried to do is create something extremely direct that clearly performs a rather double function, that on one level it is a fairly solid, fairly well put together thing that can stand in the corner of a gallery and can be vaguely, it can be looked at, it can be considered, it's an object for consideration. You can look at it and then reflect back on the initial idea of the show and then look back at the object and start to kind of have that play of ideas in relation to a thing. On the other hand, though, it does have certain aesthetic properties that I enjoyed and I liked playing with, one of which is the fact that typically being lit from above by normal lighting, as it is in this gallery, the coloured perspex tends to cast shadows and coloured effects on the wall. So I liked the way that the piece maybe had some form of, I don't know, this is a word that I hate to use in relation to art normally, but in a way it has a kind of aura, but not an aura in the way that traditional autonomous artworks are supposed to have an aura, but a literal, visible, visual effect, almost a reflection of an idea. So what we're really dealing with here is not something which should be considered as an illustration of an idea, more as this kind of strange flickering object. If we were German, there'd probably be a word for this kind of thing. But some kind of object that has the potential to allow you to spring off with a series of ideas rather than the other way around. This object is not the result of a set of thinking. It is before the thinking, in a way. And it's a very subtle distinction, but it is a very precise distinction. So it has to have this rather, like I say, rough seduction, but it also has to have this other uncertainty about it. And it's a very... I'm looking always for these middle areas. I've been doing this for... In different ways in my work for a number of years, much less interested in defining boundary points than looking to see if there is a boundary at all, and trying to catch those middle areas between one effect and another, between one sort of structure and another, between one sort of social or political setup and another. And this piece exemplifies that in a way. And it was used, amazingly enough. People do tend to use it. They tend to stand underneath it. They don't just look at the thing. Often people feel quite comfortable standing under it and using it.
The sense I get is similar to the sense I get from a number of other pieces that we'll talk about also, which is that of not exactly ambiguity, not exactly ambivalence, but I feel it, in one sense, is functional, but I can't pin down what the function might be. Mm-hmm. As I was saying earlier, whether it's a space I want to walk into to do something or to hear something or to meet others or not.
Absolutely. And I found that in the past it's been much more the case that the kinds of objects and information that I've proposed in a gallery context have been really rooted in necessity to really have taken in a certain number of other ideas or other kind of parallel information or stuff around the work. And as you say, you're correct in that I think if you're feeling that way, then that is very good for me. It means that to a certain extent things have functioned the way they ought to function, which is to have a certain openness in a way. But obviously when you do something very precise, like screw a plate of aluminium to the wall, a 2 meter by 1 meter sheet of aluminium to the wall, in a fairly workmanlike way, it will inevitably alter the space. So in a way I have no need to really overemphasize the formalism of the work, because I know that when you make some precise changes to somewhere, that there will be a number of issues about how things actually work in relation to other things that will deal with themselves. What I'm interested in much more is how to get a kind of flicker effect.
In fact, we're talking now about a piece that we're standing next to, another piece here, which I believe is titled The What-If Scenario, in brackets, Mirrored Insulation Plate. And again, it is a sheet of industrial-grade brushed aluminium screwed directly onto the wall in a way that, again, seems to relate to the human scale, the presence of a person. There's a shadowy reflection, but it's not like the reflection of a mirror. It's a very soft reflection that suggests that there's a gap between standing here, the plate of aluminium, and the reflection. There's something else within this, which creates a sort of a strange distancing effect, which is, in a sense, I get to do with time as well as to do with image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the reasons why that should be the case is that in a way, what I feel I'm trying to work with is an aspect of time, but time without resorting to time-based media that are familiar from certain other work, such as when people are using video or tape, slide, or film. I am very interested in the aspect of of how to employ time as a major concept built into the ideas behind the work. Therefore, I am inevitably faced by a series of problems or kind of formal collapses, because it's very difficult to make work about these kind of issues without using time-based media. So, again, there has to be a certain number of issues at work in each piece, one of which can be the straightforwardness of the presentation, but another one being a necessity to kind of linger or to maybe catch something in the corner of your eye as you're passing by something that becomes less precise the more you deal with the work, the more you're in the place. And every aspect of the show, in a way, has some very basic, fundamental connection to things that I would need in order to start thinking about this kind of parallel present and parallel future. So the title Installation Plate indicates it could be a sketch of something, a sort of a memory of a future that hasn't happened, if that's possible to imagine. And therefore, that gives me a certain degree of basic formal ability to just achieve something along those lines. So it can protect the wall, for example, but it also has a mirroring function which indicates that maybe this protection isn't the only thing. And all the work in the show somehow covers a different area of basic need, like writing, communication, discussion, insulation, and even finally at a certain point, the whole idea of a scenario or a truncated, broken down storyline itself. Yet the way things are presented is not always, in a strange way, not always entirely rigorous, which sounds like an odd thing. I'm not necessarily looking for a resolution of form and content, which is a classic, you know, the classic idea of 20th century art. One of the major things at work has been the attempt to resolve the form and content of the work. And I think often in my work, one or the other is really out of sync. Either the form is completely out of sync with the content in terms of a formal, you know, literal objects overload in comparison to the set of thinking, or the other way around. And in this show, I think a lot of the emptied quality of the work is due to the fact that you have a potential overload of content and then always trying to pare down in a way, but not in the same way as a rigorous minimal artist or a rigorous conceptual artist would pare things down. It's more about that kind of disjunction between form and content that I see more and more in the most interesting art, in fact.
So now in the space next to the space that one walks into in the gallery, there's another work which, after the bracketed title that applies to all the other pieces, it is described, or rather the title is Communication Banners, and it is, in fact, two large banners, and the material is, I believe, a synthetic satin, and they're quite a sort of a brilliant, almost a marine orange suspended from the ceiling, rather like curtains but not curtains. They're not exactly flat. They have the folds from the four points from which they've been suspended. Formally it's very different from the aluminium pieces we've been talking about, but there's a sense of the way in which they relate to the space and light that they have in common, I think, with the aluminium pieces.
Yeah, I mean, I it was really by accident that I became interested in the whole idea of a banner or something that, or also the idea of a backdrop. And I'd worked slightly earlier around the idea of the Erasmus Is Late book and certain other things with the introduction of a device that could cover a wall that was neither a painting or a wall painting or any of the other ways that people normally try and cover a wall. And I'd been previously using a material called ripstop, which is maybe the sixth or seventh layer on a spacesuit, but is now more familiarly used as a kite material. And when I was working on this show, I didn't want to entirely abandon this banner idea, because there's something about the dumb simplicity of just hanging cloth on a wall that seems to act as a kind of announcement, a potential announcement, but one that is totally devoid of any specificity beyond the actual material itself. And I found this new material called cationic satin heliotrope, which is a synthetic satin that is extremely, when you're close to it, it's extremely sensitive to movement, it's extremely sensitive to air in a space. So if the door is open or if people walk past, it tends to react. It also seems much heavier. It looks much heavier than it actually is. It's much lighter than it appears to be. And there were a number of reasons for using this particular strong color, one of which was to somehow puncture or drain the authority of the silvery aluminium. Because if you start using a material like aluminium in a gallery context, of course, there are immediate cross-references to art that has already been done. People like Donald Judd immediately springs to mind. And it's really amazing. If you do something in aluminium and you put it in a gallery, it has a kind of authority before you've even done anything. So I chose this particularly strong golden orange for the banners because of what it actually does partly to the aluminium, which is it drains it of its authority. It turns back into a silvery, dull, greyish neo-industrial material because the gold is golden orange is so synthetic, basically. In a way, the piece is, the word communication appears in the title because they somehow amplify effects. They're a delayed reaction, the amplification of something that would take place in the room, but something that wouldn't necessarily be something spoken, because although they'll react to air, they'll react much more to movement. So if you walk past it, like I say, they'll tend to flicker, but there'll be a slight time delay in that flicker. They're also emblematic in the sense that they seem to maybe announce something. They seem to, if you see a piece of draped cloth hanging on the side of a building, hanging outside a building, hanging on a wall, it's either for a decorative purpose or an announcing purpose. And I quite like playing with these whole ideas of the potential of design, what it means for someone dealing with the ideas that I'm dealing with to acknowledge the potential of design. So there are kind of subplots to my choice of this kind of material for a number of reasons to do with what actually happens in the formal presentation of objects in a space. It's very reactive to the other things. It was chosen at the last minute. It was the last thing that I chose in order to kind of jolt some of the visual effects of the show into a different kind of area. If I'd used a different kind of cloth, if I'd used a very heavy black, or if I'd used something silvery, there would have been a very different effect. It would have actually boosted the look of the platforms and the mirrored plates.
Is there a way in which you've, in a sense, reversed your strategy in this exhibition, in the sense that it's full of physical manifestations, it's full of objects that do not proceed, it would seem, from a text directly?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a difficult issue because there are a lot of debates about the idea of how to formalize information, and I've been involved in a number of projects in the last few years where the main gist of the show or the combination of artists has been to somehow look at ideas beyond questions of resolving form and content into a number of objects. So what you've ended up with is maybe something to do with a kind of what I've thought of as the really real syndrome, where you're introducing apparently unart-like objects and structures into a gallery, or certain processes, or you're revealing certain information. Now, the thing that's always been important for me to recognize and also to argue about is the fact that these other techniques or ways of of using a space also have a formal dimension, and they're something, and the, you know, when you see the presentation of some information in a space, you're never just seeing some information. There have been a number of aesthetic choices at every moment. So I don't think that this show is particularly, I mean, on the surface it may seem somewhat different in a way, but the fact that what is shared may be a certain attitudes and concepts rather than the fact that I might have done something in Vienna which where the only formalized result that you could assess and look at was a series of papers in a number of folders. And here I've presented a number of things which have a potential to be looked at or considered as aesthetic objects.
I get a strong sense of the works upstairs, and we're looking at discussion platform and report platform of physical interventions within an architectural space. So that presumably is a particular characteristic of the show, that relationship to architecture mm-hmm. and the human scale.
Yeah, very much so. What's happened more and more in the last couple of years is that it's become necessary for me to also produce a series of things where the space is affected in a very physical way, that while they're both objects for contemplation and for looking at, and I'm quite happy for people to come in and read the work and play with the work as if it's something to look at, I also consider it very important to take into account the relationship between people and the things. These are not just neutralized objects that are presented for looking at. They are something which, I mean, a couple of years ago I even used this phrase about work to stand with your back to, that I felt that the relationship between the viewer and the work was not necessarily one of looking, going away, thinking about it, maybe coming and looking again, but more, not exactly of use, but something that flickers between all these things. So the person who comes to use the show or look at the show may find themselves thinking about something else, getting involved in something else, some other kind of discussion, a kind of gathering place, various things that are very hard to pin down. They're very hard to... They're the kind of halfway areas between effects. And it's always in my work, I've had this interest in not so much which side of the barricade are you on, but whether or not there is a barricade, and investigating points where effects and ideas meet, and trying to occupy those tiny, tiny spaces in between effects or in between ideas, and opening those tiny spaces up for as long as it's useful in my work. What you're actually looking at most of the time are things that I've had to make in order to proceed with this work. I've had to come up with some images and some objects for myself in order to proceed with the idea, because it was too big and too clumsy a set of thinking to deal with without having something tangible and concrete and physical to actually work off. So it's strange, really, because although we're actually looking at, for example, with the discussion platform, a large-ish 2-meter square platform, a bit like a suspended ceiling, bolted into the corner of a room with a single pole, again 2 meters high, holding it up at one corner, with the spaces which you would have in something like a suspended ceiling filled with different pieces of coloured perspex, we're seeing something very tangible, very solid. In a way, for me, it's a kind of note. It's a notation. It's something like a kind of... it's source material for something else. And I like this play between the idea that while on one hand it's a clearly solid made object, and on the other hand it's just a piece of source material for me, for later.